Hello, welcome to the House of Commons. This is a podcast about politics. I'm Mark Thompson, and I'm delighted to be joined by Emma Burnell. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Mark. Lovely to be with you again.
Yes, and you. We used to do these quite regularly up until a while ago, and then it's kind of stopped. I've been filling this this podcast stream uploaded with various episodes of a radio show that I've been doing since September last year, which some people will have heard. I've kind of taken a hiatus over the summer, but that should be coming back in the autumn. But we thought that it would be a good idea to do a special House of Comments episode in the light of really what is probably the most momentous political decision that the country has taken, certainly in my lifetime, possibly for, well, since the war, I would suggest. What do you think, Emma?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's been anything like it.
Yeah, I mean, just in case anyone who's listening doesn't know what we're talking about, because I haven't explicitly referred to it, the EU referendum, which was held on Thursday. So we're recording this on Saturday morning. And the result was leave, which I think surprised quite a lot of people. Even judging by some kind of post-referendum analysis, a lot of the people who voted for leave didn't seem to think leave was going to win. Some of them seemed to do it as a bit of a protest. But it was 52% leave, 48% remain. So therefore, unless something changes, then what will happen is that there will be set in train a process by which we will eventually leave the European Union. Emma, what are your initial thoughts on all of this?
I mean, it's a mess, isn't it? As you say, it's the biggest thing that's happened to the country in certainly in our lifetimes, and I think almost the war was probably a bigger decision. We've been to wars before. It may not have been that when we went to that war, we didn't know it was a world war, as it were, if you know what I mean. Whereas with this, we kind of knew how big a decision we were making. And that's the difference in some ways. It's not something that's crept up. This is make a big, 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 big decision, and that's it. You and I are both on the same side of this argument, unlike some of our previous podcasts.
Well, actually, just on that, I mean, we are both Remainers, and I did actually try and get someone from Leave to come on, but I think they're just all too knackered, and I thought rather than wait around until someone's ready, you know, while it's still fresh, I thought we'd record it now. So we'll do our best to try and not be too biased, but I think realistically, given what's happened, we're going to probably struggle a little bit with that, but we'll do our best.
And yeah, there are arguments in both cases. This is, you know, one of the things that annoys me about referenda is, you know, make a black and white decision on a massive issue that is just not black and white. Very few things are black and white. So yeah, I think we can probably at least put the arguments that the Leave camp would have put had they been able to come on, and you know, they can stand up and answer for what they've done when we see what the results are. I mean, it's certainly safe to say that the last 48 hours have not been good for Britain. We've lost something like £350 billion off our economy. That's three times the national budget of the NHS, for anyone who's counting. We are in incredibly momentous times. Now, whether we can steady the ship and come out of this stronger, that remains to be seen. That's certainly the calculation, the risk that the Leave camp were prepared to take. And what's interesting is that so were half the country. And we're not generally a risk-taking country. So we are looking at something whereby the risk of the unknown was seen by a majority of this country as the better option than the status quo. And that's something that those of us who, like myself, campaigned vigorously for Remain, we really need to ask ourselves some very, very tough questions about why that is.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I wasn't part of the campaign as such. I didn't go out and knock on doors and deliver leaflets. I was describing myself, certainly before the referendum, as a fairly half-hearted Remainer. I could definitely see arguments on both sides, and I'm not massively enthusiastic about the EU. In fact, frankly, quite a lot of what the EU really does really pisses me off. And in fact, the reaction to what's happened post-referendum has pissed me off as well, because it does feel like this kind of faceless, sclerotic bureaucracy that kind of sits over the water and dictates to us. I can completely, at a kind of gut level, I get that, I understand it. But I still think, despite all that, that we're better off in, that we're better off sitting around a table and trying to, you know, come to compromises on things with them than being on the outside and not being able to influence those decisions at all, but probably still having to pay some kind of money towards it and still have to obey all the rules. For me, that was the clinching argument. It didn't really seem sensible to me to just flounce out and then find a few months or a couple of years later, we're still largely having to obey all of those rules anyway. Maybe at the margins there'll be some stuff we won't have to do, but most of the stuff that seems to anger people the most, like the you know, the ability for people to come here from Europe, from the EU area, and you know, some of the other stuff, you know, having to pay money in and all the rest of it, I think quite a lot of that will still apply, whatever deal we come up with. So it kind of felt a little bit like a false prospectus that we were being sold. And that was before we had things like Nigel Farage the morning after saying, well, there won't be £350 million for the NHS, like was emblazoned on the side of the Leave battle bus.
Yeah.
I mean, some people in Farage's defence have said on Twitter, well, he wasn't actually part of the official Leave campaign. And someone else rather sneeringly said, which Leave do you mean? To which my response was, how many of the 17 million people do you think understood that there was more than one Leave campaign?
Absolutely.
It's like, you know, I'm afraid that just simply doesn't wash.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I think Nigel Farage has behaved in a really ugly manner throughout this campaign, and has got uglier and uglier. And he was ugliest in Victory. The speech he made at, what, about 5, 6 in the morning, where he literally used the phrase, not a bullet has been fired, when there are three inside my French oak box.
Yeah.
It's just, it's beyond, I mean, I don't like using very strong terms about politicians. I think that we dehumanise them far too often. And I think that that is part of the problem, certainly that the Remain camp had, that anyone who was a politician is automatically a liar. And therefore, if they're trying to make an argument for something, then they are lying about it. And I think that the Leave camp had Farage and Boris, who seem to exist in this, although not real, politicians' world, which enables them to get away from that. So I don't like using strong terms about politicians, but I genuinely felt that there was something quite evil about saying that.
I mean, I think I'm not going to try and defend him. I'm just going to say that it was 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning. He was obviously completely knackered. I think he was drunk, and I suspect he'd just forgotten. You could argue that it's terrible that he'd forgotten about that. But I just think in the moment he got swept up and he used a phrase that he probably regretted afterwards as soon as someone said, what about Joe Cox? And it suddenly occurred to him. I don't think he maliciously and deliberately used that phrase. I think he was busking and he probably does regret it.
Well, I would hope so. But I think you're being far too generous to a man who has shown no generosity to anybody else.
That is true. He has not shown any generosity of spirit to anyone else. And maybe I am being too generous to him. But
given that he was on the telly 2 days after the shooting saying that Remain were using it and it was disgusting and the only people who were politicising it were Remain, I'm sorry, I don't believe that. You know, and this is not what a lot of people who voted Leave. You know, they are not evil people. They're not bad people. They're people with a difference of opinion to me. And when that's their figurehead, you can see how we then become so divided and have such a nasty. I mean, this has been a nasty referendum. All referendums are, as far as I can tell. I mean, yeah, I was following the one in Scotland 2 years ago very closely, and you know, people I know were getting spit on for campaigning in that. And this was just as bad. And it just, our country is divided now. That was a very close result, you know, only 4 percentage points in it. We are two countries that are really almost feel irreconcilable at the moment. And how we come together is going to be really, really tough.
Yeah. And it's the splits go kind of in a multidimensional way, don't they? Because there's a definite generational split. I mean,
yeah.
Something like 75% of under 30-year-olds voted for Remain, and something like 2/3 of pensioners voted to leave. And I think there is a genuine question here to be answered about how fair that is, because I tweeted something a day or so ago that had a little chart that demonstrated the average life expectancy of the demographic, you know, the older demographic, the pensioner demographic, and the average life expectancy of the youngest demographic. And, you know, what that spells out is that the people who are in the older demographic are only going to have to live with the consequences of this decision for on average 15 years, because they won't live any longer than that. And realistically, actually, how long is it going to take before the effects of this are really felt? Because it could easily be several years before we properly negotiate exit terms, and then we have a bit of time to get used to the new world. So most of them probably won't be alive to see the consequences, whereas the youngest demographic will live for probably another maybe 50 or 60 years and be having to deal with the consequences. This isn't like a general election. I mean, it was run like a general election campaign. There were battle buses. There were people making pledges. But this isn't something that you can change your mind about in 3 or 4 or 5 years' time when there's another general election. You know, this was a momentous decision. And to a large extent, I mean, I have read some pieces that are talking about how we might be able to have a second referendum, but I think realistically it's irreversible. And therefore, I don't know what the answer to that is, because I'm not saying that older people shouldn't be allowed to vote in referenda. But I do wonder if we need to take a couple of steps back from this. And I was saying this before the campaign. I certainly said it in the aftermath of the AV referendum. And part of the problem is I've been on the losing side now of the two national referenda that have been held in, that have included England, where I live. And so it could easily look like sour grapes here. You know, maybe if the AV referendum had won, and maybe if Remain had won, then it's possible I might have taken a different view. But I don't think so, because it's not so much the result, it's the way that the campaigns have been run. I mean, the AV referendum was, as far as I'm concerned, preposterous. The stuff that was said from the No to AV side was just, it didn't even bear any relation to what was on the ballot paper. And from the post-analysis that was done, you can see that lots of people voted No to AV because they just didn't like Nick Clegg and they wanted to punish him for tuition fees. That's not what was on the ballot paper.
Yeah.
I completely understand that people were furious with the Lib Dems. I was furious with the Lib Dems. I left the Lib Dems in 2013 over various compromises they'd made and the way that they just didn't seem to have made any changes to the political system that I was hoping for. You know, I'm angry as well. But the idea that you reject a pretty minor change to the voting system because you don't like Nick Clegg is... In the end, people are going to vote for whatever reasons they have, but that is not why the referendum was held. And I think we've seen a similar dynamic here, which is that nominally on the ballot paper, the question was, do you want to remain in the European Union or do you want to leave? And I am certain that when they do the analysis on this, when the political scientists and the sophologists and the pollsters do all of the analysis, which they will do, and there will be lots of it from this because it's such a momentous result, they will see that lots and lots of people who voted for leave did so for reasons other than because they wanted to leave the EU. There are people living in deprived areas who were just furious about their lives, and it was just a chance to kick at the political establishment. And ironically, those people, if things go the way I fear now that we're going to leave the EU, will actually be in a worse position. And it makes me really worry about what will happen afterwards, because
realise they've been sold a dummy.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, the kind of the cry of fury that and anguish that this referendum has allowed them.
Yeah, this is absolutely a cri de coeur. Let's be in no doubt. People are crying out for some sort of change, and what they've done is go, well, here's a change. Let's go for it. Things cannot get any worse.
Yeah, and I just should say as well, I'm sure quite a lot of people who voted leave did so because they genuinely want to leave the EU. I'm not discounting that at all. But what I'm saying is, if it had been 2/3 leave, I wouldn't be having this discussion. I'd just say, well, that's an overwhelming majority. Yeah. Okay. But it was pretty close. And so when it's pretty close, you have to start asking how well informed were the electorate about this, because it's such a momentous decision. And it might sound a bit strange and a bit silly, and I'm sure there are going to be lots of campaigners on the Leave side who will just say, this is sour grapes. There was a 8-week campaign, there were There was TV debate after TV debate. People had plenty of time to understand what was going on. But to that, I would just say $350 million for the NHS, plastered on the side of the battle bus, and this idea that basically immigration would either stop or be massively reduced. And I know, again, people on the Leave campaign will say, but we never explicitly said any of that, but that was the overwhelming message. That was the tone of the campaign. That is what people will have thought when they went into the polling booths, that they were voting for a lot more money for the NHS and to put a massive brake on migration. And realistically, there won't be any more money for the NHS, and Nigel Farage has basically admitted that. And I'd be astonished if in 10 or 15 years' time there was any difference to migration, because yes, we live in a globalised world. It is completely unrealistic to expect it. And not only that, but actually we need immigration because we've got an ageing population. And if you look at the NHS and you look at all kinds of other institutions in this country, lots of the people who work in them are migrants. We need them. You know, that is the truth. I heard very few people on the campaign trail say that, because it's not a truth that people like to hear, but we do need them. You know, people like me, I'm in my early 40s now. By the time I get to retirement age, if that ever happens in another, say, 25, 30 years' time, you know, there will be so many of my age at that point, it will become incredibly top-heavy, and we need people of working age.
It's insane. If we don't have, you are much, much more likely to be treated by a migrant in the NHS than you are to have one in front of you in the queue. There is also the fact that most of the really low-skilled migration that people are worried about is coming from outside the EU as well.
Yeah. And there's no prospect of doing anything about that.
No. And, we are a country. What's fascinating to me is when you look at the breakdown of where people voted Remain the most and where people voted Stay the most, it is areas of high migration, places you would expect to have, if it were a big problem, to have the biggest problem, are massively pro-Remain. London boroughs were voting sort of 70-80% Remain. Really, really high figures. I've got some of them if I can find them. The places that weren't are not places where they have a great deal of immigration. It's places where they're worried about it, where they think it's coming, and where their circumstances are already incredibly depressed.
I think, to be fair, there are some parts of the country where there has been a large influx of migrants, and they're clustered in very tightly knit areas, and people resent that. And in areas like that, people are quite anti-migration as well. So I don't think it's quite as black and white as it's only people who live in areas where there are very few migrants who are just scared of the other because they're not familiar with it. I understand the dynamic you're talking about certainly does have an effect, but there are definitely areas where people have seen migration in their area and they perceive it to have been negative for various reasons. I read a comment on a blog yesterday where someone was talking about a council estate very near where they live, where there's 500 people, lots of them are out of work. A new Aldi opened, and lots of people on the council estate applied for jobs at the Aldi. None of them even got an interview. And then the Aldi opened, and there were 16 workers in there, all of whom were from Eastern Europe. Mm. When things like that happen, you can totally understand why people get absolutely frustrated and furious about it. So I think, again, this is the problem, because it's not, as you rightly said earlier on, it's not a black and white issue. It's not, this isn't something that just easily slots into a binary decision. Yes or no, in or out, migration is terrible or brilliant. It's such a nuanced, complex, mixed picture. Yeah. And that's why, for issues like this, we have a representative democracy where we have people who are sent to Parliament to debate and deliberate and discuss these issues and make decisions, informed decisions on that basis, not a plebiscite where people just go into a polling booth and tick a yes or no box, however well informed they are. You know, some people will have been incredibly well informed and some people won't have been, but they all get the same votes. And in the end, you know, that's how this decision was taken.
Yeah, exactly. And I know politicians get a really, really hard time, and I know I've already said something on this, but in terms of, these complex decisions, the reason that one of the reasons we get frustrated with Parliament is it takes a long time to do anything, and that can feel very slow. When you want a decision, do something, something must be done. They're awful cries. Something must be done, therefore people end up doing anything. Mm. But actually, one of the reasons it's slow is because they take their time scrutinising things, going over it. The government will put a bill and the opposition and some of their own MPs will go through it, literally, line by line.
Yeah.
Checking whether it works, checking whether it has unintended consequences, trying to change it, trying to strengthen it, trying to weaken it sometimes, you know, depending on where you stand or what the bill's trying to do. But they really go through legislation with a fine-tooth comb. And, you know, there is... We think that a bill gets a yay or nay because we watch that final debate in the House of Commons. But actually, the run-up to that and the difference between the first bill that's put and the final bill that's decided on is usually quite enormous.
Mm.
And that is because people are able to do more than just say yes or no.
Yeah.
And we don't get that when we're given a plebiscite. We literally have to go yay or nay. Yeah. To something that's so ridiculously complicated. You know, if you ask people on a bill, would you like to change the EU? Would you like to change it in this way, that way, the other way? I would be saying yes. I didn't get that option. I didn't get to say in this referendum, yes, but.
Yeah. Or, you know, a score between 0 and 10. You know, 0 means leave, 10 means stay.
Yeah, well, I'll give it 7 or 7.5, shall we?
Yeah, for anyone who's not aware, that's a reference to Jeremy Corbyn's comment when he was on the last leg. I actually tweeted about it yesterday and I said, you know, that does not look clever now. But this is part of the problem because everything gets squeezed through the binary filter. So even me, when I'm saying, you know, it's not good, it's squeezed through a binary filter, I was still criticising Corbyn because he was trying to be nuanced. He was trying to be nuanced, and actually he probably reflected the vast majority of the people who voted Remain. Most people who voted Remain probably were only at 7.5% at most. In terms of, you know, scale of 0 to 10, you know, how well do you rate the EU? Probably less, actually. But, yeah, a campaign like this and a way of voting for something like this doesn't lend itself to nuance.
No, and the more that we do this, and this has been the third referendum in, what, 6 years?
Yeah, including the one in Scotland.
Yeah. The more we do this, the more we put ourselves on one side of a fence or another. Yeah, you and I were on different sides on the AV referendum, and you felt very passionate about it. I didn't. I didn't really care all that much.
Yeah, but also, yeah. When you explained to me your reasoning why, I mean, I didn't agree with you, but I completely respected it, and I could see you had a point. I mean, I still remember your argument for that. You said that you were worried you would end up with kind of mushy middle candidates.
Yeah,
I completely understood that. I know, I got that. I didn't agree with it, but I could see your reasoning and why you'd come to that conclusion.
Yeah, no, if I were to make a choice on another voting system that wasn't AV, AV Plus, for example, I'd have been fine with it. But yeah. If they want to have a voting reform, just bloody put it in your manifesto and do it. Stop making the country make these stupid... Stop abnegating your responsibility, politicians. I am usually the number one champion of... being reasonable about politicians. But I feel that this referendum, we had this referendum because David Cameron had a problem with his right flank of his party. It was an internal politics thing. He needed to sort out some of his internal politics, and he was too weak not to give them the referendum they'd been calling for. And he abdicated the responsibility of saying, no, hang on, I firmly believe, as the man who was surprisingly elected Prime Minister, you know, no one expected him to win a majority last year, I am the man that the country has turned to make decisions on its behalf. I firmly believe staying in the EU is the right thing. That's that.
Yeah, but to political reality was such, certainly after he put it in his manifesto and he'd campaigned for it so hard.
Yeah, but he never should have put it in his manifesto. And as I said, that was a decision. So it was, you know, a couple of things happened. First of all, they thought they were going to have to negotiate with the Lib Dems to go back into coalition, and that would have been one of the things they'd negotiate out. And secondly, he didn't put it in his manifesto because he thought it was the right thing for the country.
No, I know. But the thing is, I mean, I tweeted about this. I mean, I should probably write a fairly lengthy blog post about it, but... he did that. He said that he wanted a referendum. And he said, and he put it in the manifesto because he basically had no choice. And when I say that, what I mean is, if he'd not have done that, there would have been more defections to UKIP. There were already two defections in the previous parliament. There would have been more. And I'm sure that they would have won the subsequent by-elections. And in the election campaign, instead of getting 4 million votes, UKIP could easily have got 5 or 6 or 7 million votes and could have actually won quite a few seats and would definitely have deprived the Tories of seats, even if they'd have not won some of them. And therefore, Cameron wouldn't have been Prime Minister to even have done it. So what he effectively did was kick the can down the road in the hope that he could do what he always does when there's a political crisis, which is come out fighting. And he is very good when his back's against the wall, and he thought that he could, through dint of his political skills and his personality, win the referendum campaign. Now, it was a gamble that failed, but had he not have put the referendum in his manifesto, he wouldn't have even been Prime Minister to hold it anyway.
I think he'd have been Prime Minister. He'd have been Prime Minister of a coalition rather than Prime Minister of a majority government.
I really don't think so, because if you look at the majority of some of the Tory MPs, they're so slim that with a different dynamic in the election campaign, I just think that you would have ended up with Ed Miliband as Prime Minister with a minority government with the SNP having sway. I mean, I'm not saying that would have been a brilliant position to be in, but I don't think Cameron would have been Prime Minister. He wouldn't be leader. He'd have been ejected. So I don't think he'd have been in a position to do anything. Even if I'm wrong about that, even if we were able to run it again, it turns out you're right, I still think Cameron feared that that's what was going to happen and that's why he did it.
Well, again, then, what he did was gamble the country's future on his own position.
Yes, I agree.
That's no more noble than gambling his country's future on the internal politics of the Conservative Party.
No, and actually, it's like a literal tragedy, because if you follow the timeline of what happened, he'd promised the referendum, and then he, in the aftermath of the Scottish independence referendum, which he'd won, he then stood on the doorstep of Downing Street and made it all about English votes for English laws, which he knew. Alistair Darling had called him at about 4 a.m.
Begged
him not to do this, but he did it anyway, which was to make it all about English votes for English laws, which he knew would cause Labour massive problems in Scotland, which he then knew would lead to the SNP doing very, very well in the subsequent general election. And he knew that he could use that as a stick to beat Labour with, to be able to win a majority. And at the same time, they did everything that they possibly could to absolutely torpedo the Lib Dems and cannibalise their coalition partners and steal their seats from them, which was also successful. And the net result of all of that is that he then had to hold the referendum that he never wanted to hold in the first place. So it's like a confluence of all of these things.
Well, and we are now extremely likely to leave Scotland.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. So that is also true. So despite what a fervent unionist he claimed to be, he must have known that losing this EU referendum would mean it very, very likely that Scotland would secede from the Union within a few years. So that demonstrates how little he really, truly wanted Scotland to remain in the Union, because if he'd been that passionate about it, he'd have done everything he possibly could to not have an EU referendum. But so
yeah,
it demonstrates that, again, that was not seen as something important enough to try and find a different way to do this.
I mean, ultimately, David Cameron is going to be seen by history as the man who took us out of the EU and the man who set in wheels the motion that we might lose Scotland.
Yeah.
That's an incredible legacy.
Yeah, and I think he'll be seen as the worst Prime Minister since Eden for that reason, which, you know, worse than Gordon Brown. I mean, I said this on Twitter, and I think he's going to be seen as the worst Prime Minister, certainly since the Suez crisis. And someone said, what, even Gordon Brown? I said, yes, even Gordon Brown. Gordon Brown didn't do anything like this.
No.
He wasn't a good Prime Minister, and I really didn't like him, and I blogged about it a hell of a lot of the time, and I talked about it on the radio and on podcasts, but he never did anything like this.
No, Gordon Brown...
He's seen as a towering giant compared to Cameron now.
In terms of his political legacy, Gordon Brown's is pretty strong. He was in charge during the crisis, and in the end, we didn't go into a depression, we went into a recession. And that was partly because of decisions made by Alistair Darling and Gordon Brown.
Hmm. Can we just
a good person in terms of you wouldn't want to work for him.
No.
But that's a different matter. His political legacy is reasonably strong.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest problem I had with Brown is that he spent 10 years, more than 10 years, plotting to become Prime Minister, and when he got there, he didn't know what to do with it. I mean,
I couldn't disagree with that at all. Yeah. But I think there's a great deal of difference between a person is not the right person for the job, and therefore has not done the job well, and I think that could be easily said about Gordon Brown, to the person has left a disastrous legacy for the country.
Yeah, and I think day to day, I think David Cameron was a better Prime Minister than Gordon Brown. I think he was just better at the role. I think he, you know, when it came to things like standing up in Parliament and talking about, what happened on Bloody Sunday and Hillsborough and all stuff like that, I think he felt prime ministerial in that respect. But, you know, his backroom politicking has finally undone him, and he will now. I mean, he must know this as well. You know, I think part of the reason why his voice was cracking and breaking when he was making his speech in Downing Street is because he knows the game's up. It's all over. It's not just that he's no longer going to be Prime Minister in a few months' time. It's that he has completely and utterly tainted his own legacy now.
Yeah.
This will be what he's remembered for. You know, Tony Blair is remembered for Iraq. David Cameron will be remembered for this. And there's nothing he can do about that now. He's completely and utterly screwed in that respect. Can we just come back to Scotland, though? Because I kind of stated that Scotland will almost certainly go out. I mean, is that true, do you think?
Yes, I'm afraid. And I really, really hope I'm wrong. I have Scottish friends. I was actually campaigning up in Scotland for a friend of mine who was running for Scottish Parliament in the last set of elections. Who feels so passionately British rather than just, I mean, they're passionately Scottish. I've never met anyone more passionately Scottish than Joanna, but also passionately British, passionate about the union. And, you know, the referendum was less close than this one up there. But I think if there wasn't an area of Scotland that voted to leave the EU, and they are feeling very, very gypped today. And yeah, of course they are. And I think this might be the thing that swings it. And Nicola Sturgeon has already said she'll be calling for a second referendum on Scottish independence so that they can stay in Europe. And frankly, I can't see a case being made to them that they should stay. I mean, they've already had these extra powers, and I think, you know, that hasn't made enough difference. And they want to stay in the EU. And I think they will make that quite rational choice. I wish they wouldn't. Emotionally, I don't want to lose the union. But I'm very afraid that we will.
Let me just set out a potential alternative. I think I agree with you. I think it is now the most likely scenario is within the next few years, Scotland will have another referendum. They will leave the United Kingdom. I agree. But I think there is cause for potential optimism in that, okay, this is going to come out as a little bit of a stream of consciousness. I don't think that Boris Johnson actually wanted to leave the EU. I think he chose to campaign for the Leave side because he saw it as the shortest route to Downing Street. And I think he's been proven right in that respect.
Yeah.
But I actually don't think he wants the UK to leave the EU. I certainly don't think he wants to spend the entirety of his premiership trying to deal with the minutiae of trying to negotiate with the EU to work out, you know, how we can navigate this and end up with something that, you know, works for us and works for them, but we're out. However, we are where we are. But I think instinctively, if Johnson can find a way of, I mean, it's going to be tricky, it's going to be diplomatically tricky, but straddling two horses at the same time. So making it seem like we've left the EU, but actually what we've done is fiddled around at the margins, changed a few things, managed to change the rules enough that he can sell it to the public that it's changed. And maybe in name, we are no longer in the EU, but we have some kind of relationship with them that isn't massively different from now. Then it's possible that we might be able to sell that to Scotland and say, look, you know, we've still got a pretty good deal here and we'd like you to stay. Now, the reason why this is such a tricky sell is because he's going to have to basically do two things at the same time. He's going to have to convince the United Kingdom in general that we've left the EU, but he's going to have to convince Scotland that we sort of haven't really.
Well, and also he has to convince the EU to give us a good deal, and I thought, why on earth they would?
I agree right now, because, you know, people are feeling very hurt and very bruised. But I wonder if in the end, because without some sort of decent deal with the United Kingdom, the EU will actually be shooting itself in the foot. I mean,
Well, yes and no, Mark, because they have to make it very, very clear, because this could set off a domino effect. The EU have to make it very clear for a very long time that leaving the EU has massive, massive consequences.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I know. And that's why what I've just set out, I'd put at no greater possibility than 10%, probably less. But it's a path that I could imagine a very clever politician who wants to try and have his cake and eat it could, under the right circumstances, find a way to navigate that course. And actually, what I know about Boris Johnson is that he probably is clever enough to navigate a course like that if he really wanted to. I don't think it'll happen for the reasons you've said and for other reasons as well. I mean, I think in the end, the momentum is just going to be behind getting out, both from the side of the United Kingdom, from the side of his backbenchers, and from the EU itself. They're going to want us out because they don't want this contagion of countries thinking that they can leave and there to be very few consequences to spread very much. But, you know, if you're looking for a little kernel of potential optimistic hope, that's one possibility. But yeah, a pretty remote one. I mean, I've been talking about Boris Johnson as if he's definitely going to be the next prime minister. Do you think that's true? Do you think there's a chance it'll be someone else? Usually the Tory leadership is not won by the favourite. Normally someone else comes through and ends up being the stop the favourite candidate and wins.
They do, and Boris is very Marmite, as I understand it, within the Tory party. The members absolutely adore him. If he gets on the final ballot, I think he'll win. The MPs might stop him in the way that they stopped various people before who they didn't like.
They stopped Portillo, for example, didn't they?
Exactly.
That's why Ian Duncan Smith won, because it ended up between Duncan Smith and Ken Clark. And Ken Clark could never have won in the country because he was a Europhile. And actually, Portillo was only kept off by one vote. But I think in the situation with Boris, it's a bit different than Portillo, isn't it? Because he's so beloved by the party that if he was kept off the ballot, wouldn't there just be massive insurrection within the Tory membership ranks?
When isn't there massive insurrection within the Tory membership ranks?
Right, worse insurrection, then. Much worse.
Yes, possibly, but they may look at the Labour Party and go, you know what, that's a price worth paying.
Yeah.
We'll
come to Corbyn in a minute, but yeah.
Sometimes you should choose the right choice for the choice the country might prefer rather than the choice that the membership might prefer.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's overwhelmingly likely it'll be Boris. I think.
I mean, I'm like you. I'm not putting the necessarily most likely scenario. I'm just exploring the options.
Yeah, sure. I'd put it at a pretty low percentage chance that it isn't Boris, but it might be quite interesting to see who he ends up in the last two with. Could be Theresa May. I think it would be quite good if it was Theresa May, actually. And I think, I think I'd prefer Theresa May to Boris Johnson to win.
I prefer Theresa May. I think Theresa May's problem is that she's sort of all over the place. In her political journey. I mean, and so is Boris, but there is the definition of it all over the place. It's in dictionary, see Boris. but he gets away with it in a way that Theresa doesn't. I mean, she started off as the original modernizer, didn't she, with the Nazi Party speech.
Yeah. Yeah.
But actually, she's become much more of the Tory right. And never really sort of part of the Cameron set. So she was sort of IDS's modernizer, which is a slightly bizarre thing to be.
I think that there'll be a place for her in a senior cabinet role, though.
Under
Johnson.
I have quite a lot of respect for her. She's made a few mistakes. Who doesn't? Who hasn't? But I think she's a good politician.
Well, the fact that she's survived in the Home Office for over 6 years tells its own story, doesn't it?
Well, it doesn't, it doesn't. It's much, much easier to be a Tory Home Secretary than a Labour one.
That's a fair point.
And Jackie Smith lasted a reasonably long time, if I remember rightly, before Theresa May.
I can't remember exactly how long it was.
Yeah. But, I think that... I don't agree with some of her political decisions, but I think she's done a pretty good job at holding that role together. Mm. And it is a tough role, particularly when we're facing quite severe cuts to police numbers. It's an unusual decision for a Tory government to go to war with the police rather than using the police. So that's a new one. And she's actually navigated that pretty well, I think.
Yeah. So maybe just in the last few minutes, let's just talk about Corbyn, because you kind of alluded to his leadership there. There is a motion of no confidence being tabled by his MPs, which I think will be, there'll be a ballot, a secret ballot, I believe, on Monday, is that right?
Yeah, the PLP meets on Monday evenings.
I mean,
PLP is Parliamentary Labour Party.
If it's a secret ballot, it's pretty likely that they'll vote no confidence, isn't it?
Yeah, I would have thought so.
Okay, what would the consequences of that be? Do you think there then will be a leadership election?
Well, it's non-binding, as I understand it, but it will be such a strong thing that it may have to be a leadership election. There are all sorts of questions. The Labour Party constitution isn't terribly clear. So an awful lot of these decisions will be made by the National Executive Committee. Now, the National Executive Committee is made up of a lot of different people, and they're not all Corbyn supporters. And only six of them are elected by the membership. A further 12 are elected from various unions. There are people who represent the socialist societies, people who represent BAME Labour, etc., etc. So there's lots of different seats on the NEC that come from different places. Some of them represent the PLP. Some of them represent the leadership. So the NEC will, in the end, decide on and set the rules for any contest. And there are contested understanding of what those rules might be. So it is not understood whether, if there is a challenge, because the Labour Party don't really do leadership challenges. We're not like the Tories, who seem to do them every other week. If the incumbent automatically goes on the ballot. If they do, game over, Jeremy just wins again with probably a bigger margin.
Well, hang on. Are you sure about that?
Yes, I'm absolutely certain. If you look at the internal polling of the Labour Party, he gets more support than he got votes originally.
Okay. Because I was wondering if after the pretty shambolic 9 or 10 months that he's been leader, if that might have changed.
I think it will change to a certain extent, and I think some of that polling is the fact that Labour Party members say, yes, we support our leader, and that's what we do. But I think that there is an extraordinary feeling from the Labour Party at the moment. If you are critical of Corbyn at all, you are a Blairite traitor. I've never been called a Blairite so much before. It's bizarre. If anyone's not a Blairite, it's me. But, you know, everyone who's even vaguely critical, and sometimes unsupportive and sometimes uncritical. I try to be quite balanced in this. But the moment that you're critical, you're written off as a Blairite and that's it. Any idea that Corbyn may be doing anything less than a sterling job is a complete conspiracy by the mainstream media. We have become a party of 9/11 conspiracy theorists. It's bizarre. And it's a real shame because, you know, and these are not bad people at all. They're just people who are so passionate and in their desire to be better informed, read a great deal of stuff that doesn't necessarily help in that. I mean, I'm thinking of that Bloody Canary website, which is essentially Pravda. I mean, it's extraordinary propaganda. I was talking to a friend yesterday about the referendum rather than about the Labour Party. And she was saying, and I was agreeing, that we live in the information age, but we do not live in an age where we are taught well how to critically assess information. You know, with the the education system in this country has changed so much that we are learning by rote and being taught to the test and have been for 20, 30 years. So we are not, we no longer value the skills that we were taught like 20, 30 years ago of how to critically assess information. That's not what education, it seems to be for anymore. So we have more information at our fingertips than ever before and fewer skills as to how to discern what to do with it, what is strong information, what is weak information, how to sort the wheat from the chaff. And I think that there is a real problem whereby we get our information more and more from our own self-managed content. You don't read a newspaper anymore. You read newspaper articles that people you know and have chosen to follow put on Twitter or Facebook. And that's different.
Yeah, they call it the filter bubble, don't they, where you filtered your content and it becomes like a kind of echo chamber of self-reinforcing. That's why you end up with people utterly astonished at like election results and referendum results, because 90-odd% of the contacts that they have, you know, and the interactions that they have are with people who agree with them, and they're astonished to find that actually in the country they're in a minority.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, people... I mean, I try to follow people I disagree with, particularly on Twitter. I don't necessarily on Facebook, although I am friends with people I disagree with. But even there, I know that I'm getting a quite biased stream of information, and that if I want that to change, I have to seek out other sources. And I try also, I've always made a kind of pact with myself to read something I disagree with every day, just to make sure that I'm testing my own ideas. But that you have to really actually seek that out if you're just on Facebook following your mates, which is what most people are. I mean, I was at a fascinating conference a couple of weeks ago and they were saying, you know, most people get their information online from Facebook, not Twitter. Twitter is almost entirely the commentariat talking to each other, whereas Facebook is trusted friends sharing things. And that, you know, that means that you, particularly with Facebook being something where you're more likely just to link with friends rather than strangers, you will be getting information that is, you know, almost entirely coming through the bubble of what you and your mates are like.
Yeah.
I get the white middle class news.
Yeah. And I'm sure I'm guilty of that as well. And I don't really use Facebook. I do use Twitter, and I do try and follow people that I don't agree with and who I know are going to challenge me. But realistically, if you were to go through who I follow on Twitter, I'm sure the majority of them are going to be people who largely agree with my politics, because I don't think I'd be comfortable living in a world where I was constantly getting harangued on Twitter by all my followers and all the people I follow. Just to come back to Corbyn, though, so you seem to be implying that there might be a chance he won't get on the ballot then.
Well, this is what I say. I mean, I don't know how the rules are going to be held, but if it is that it is like any other leadership contest and you have to have, can't remember what the number was, but a percentage of the MPs nominating you.
I think it's 15%.
15% of the MPs nominating you. I can't remember what that boils down to, but it was 35, 36, something like that. Anyway.
Yeah, something like that.
Can he get 36 members of the PLP to nominate him? Because last time around he did, but only because several people who weren't going to support him nominated him to broaden the debate. Yeah. Now I think they will be less likely to do that this time around. So it may well be that there's a coup within the Labour Party that essentially says to the members, you can't have the choice you want, choose between these other guys.
Well, and how would that go down?
Very badly. Lots of people would leave. Lots of members will leave the Labour Party, but the Labour Party becomes more electable to the wider populace. That is the calculation that the PLP will be making.
I mean, I was just going to say, that is actually the best case scenario, because really what the PLP want is for loads of these new members to leave, because they don't want them, because they're the sort of people who support Corbyn, who is completely and utterly unelectable.
Well, and the problem, I mean, if they leave, that works well for PLP. If they stay and deselect them, that's slightly more complicated.
Yeah, it's a real mess, isn't it? I mean, this has been bubbling under ever since it became clear that Corbyn was going to win. So, I mean, I suppose to an extent we're just going to have to kind of watch and see. But maybe just the last thing I wanted to talk about, the reason why that I think has become so important now is because I think there will be another general election either this year or early next year, because I think whoever becomes Tory leader, whatever negotiating hand they want to take to the EU, they don't really have a mandate for that. And
yeah,
it's such a big thing that I think, never mind about Fixed Term Parliament Act and all the rest of it, they will just contrive a way of calling a general election, either by getting Labour to agree with them and then they've got 2/3 majority in the House of Commons, or to call a vote of confidence in themselves and deliberately lose it and wait 2 weeks till another government can't be formed and then have a general election, or, perhaps most likely, just repeal the Fixed Term Parliament Act. They only need a bare majority to do that. And I think they could quite easily justify and say, look, you know, circumstances have changed. It's no longer a coalition government. We've had this referendum. We have to have a mandate to go and negotiate. We need an election. We're going to repeal the Fixed Term Parliament Act. I think however that happens, whatever mechanism they use, I think we'll have another general election either later this year or early next year. And therefore, it's critically important who's leading the Labour Party. If it's Corbyn, you're going to get annihilated.
I think that's true. I mean, I'm one of the Corbyn skeptics, let's say. I didn't vote for him. I think sometimes he does good things, sometimes he does bad things. I agree with him more often than I think he's a good leader, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, his heart's in the right place, but he's a crap leader.
Yeah, and I think he's a terribly nice guy.
Yeah.
And from everything I hear from everyone on every side of the divisions in the Labour Party, he's a sterling constituency MP. You know, always has been very, very good, very, very good with his local people. But he is a natural rebel. He's a rebellious character. He's someone who has certain things that he has cared about passionately all his political life. And one of them is changing the Labour Party. But the others are, you know, things that we don't really talk about, particularly in our national conversation. They aren't big national issues. And he didn't want the job, let's be honest. It was Buggins' turn that he was the guy from the left that the left put forward at this point. And although he said he's very, very ready for a general election, I don't feel anyone else is. I think we're all knackered, disheartened. You know, we had a tough set of local elections and we didn't go as far backwards as some people thought we were going to, and we haven't fallen down in by-elections as much as some people say we're going to. So maybe it won't be as bad as I fear it would be, but, you know, I think that's reaching for optimism that I don't really have.
I think the problem is, Emma, photographs of him with Martin McGuinness and
Adams.
There's just so much that the Tories could throw him. Look at what they did to Ed Miliband, and he didn't really have anything in his closet.
Exactly. Ed Miliband fits the mould of politician in a way that Jeremy Corbyn or Prime Minister in a way that Jeremy Corbyn doesn't.
Yeah.
And they made Ed Miliband unprime-ministerial.
Exactly. They would absolutely destroy Corbyn. And that's why I think, you know, this is probably pie in the sky, but someone like Dan Jarvis, I know he's talked about a lot, but someone with a backstory like he's got, with the charisma that he's got, you know, I'm not saying it would necessarily have to be definitely him, but someone like that would have a shot at either holding the number of seats you've currently got, maybe even getting some more. I think it would be a struggle to win the general election, given where Scotland is.
Yes.
But a shot at either keeping the Tories out or keeping the majority very, very small. But with Corbyn, I just think Johnson's going to be sitting on a 3-figure majority. And I don't want to see that, but I think that's what will happen.
I think 3-figure majority is strong, given that they won't get the Scottish seats either. I think that, although Ruth Davidson's a very, very impressive politician.
Mm. We haven't even talked about her, but I think she was far and away the best debater in the six-way BBC debate.
Think in some ways Scotland is incredibly lucky at the moment. All three of the women running the Scottish parties are impressive.
Yeah.
You know, it must feel nice. And that's another reason why they might go independent. Like, look at our politics and look at yours.
Yeah.
I think that... and Boris is not the magic he thinks he is. He didn't have a great Leave campaign. He was overshadowed by Farage. He's very, very popular in some parts of the country. He's less popular in others. Now, some of those places will never vote Tory anyway, so it's not a big problem.
I think it's less that he will be incredibly popular all throughout the country. I totally get what you mean. He is a bit Marmite, and he only appeals to certain parts of the electorate. It's just what they will do to Corbyn. It's just that if you thought Project Fear was bad here.
To see it for him, you know, as someone who I've admired as a constituency MP, who I know never wanted the job, I don't want to see him go through it, frankly.
Yeah.
I think three single majority may be strong, but I think any sense that Labour would be likely to win an election, given all the information we have. Yeah, it's just not realistic.
No. Okay, well, I think we'll probably have to wrap it up here because we've talked a bit longer than I thought we were going to, but I guess that's a function of the fact it's been a long time since we've done one of these, and it's such a momentous political event with so many consequences that could flow from it. I mean, I feel like I could probably talk for another hour or two at least and still find that we've not covered
might
everything.
Might bore our listeners, though.
Indeed, yes. We better wrap it up now, but maybe we'll reconvene again in a few weeks or a few months when the dust settled and just see where we are then.
That would be lovely.
Good stuff. Maybe try and get someone from the Leave side on next time as well, just to balance it out a bit more.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Emma.
Cheers, Mark.
Just remains for me to thank Audio Boom, who very kindly hosted the podcast for us on the internet, and I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incomputech.com for our theme music.